squint, and the snow was banked up to his jowls like a starched collar. He'd only been cast from the chin up, but he still stood more than 15 feet high. I rode round him twice, leaving a wheel of prints. If that was his tomb, I owe him an apology, because the next thing I did was to shinny up his nose and sit my ass right on his big bare dome to watch the sun come up over the city. There was no warmth in those first rays, but there was something icy and beautiful in the way they sparkled on the bronze head and lit the red marble of its base and gleamed on the windows of the big square buildings that surrounded us on each side. The head sat on a raised plinth at one side of the square and faced directly east into the sunrise and out over the old city. As the sun rose higher, the square grew more dazzling bright, 3 or 4 acres of blinding virgin snow. No wonder that Bronze Head was squinting. I could see by the tracks in the snow that the prisoners had used the square to orient themselves. It must have been the clearest landmark on the maps they carried. There were tracks entering it at different points on 2 of its 4 sides, but all of them exited the same way, westwards, past the 2 blockposts that marked the separation between the new city and the old. The tallest building in the old city was probably no more than 10 stories or so, but through the spyglass I could make out some on the other side of the blockposts that were 2 or even 3 times as high. There was something so heartless and sharp about their shape, plain, straight sides, gray as granite, unadorned with any detail, nothing to tell you they'd been built by a race of men. And even the biggest of those was dwarfed by a blue metal crane which stood beside it like a huge headless bird. You'd think somehow a city would miss its people, that at least it would look incomplete without a line of washing or two, someone idling on a street corner, some children hurrying to school. But Pauline 66 looked no more short of people than a cemetery does. It was perfect just how it stood, all concrete and right angles and governed by that giant's head. To tell the truth, I think the city would have been a little spoiled if it had had people in it. Humans limp and loaf. They slouch, don't walk in straight lines, spit on the sidewalks. The city I could see through the glass looked like it would stand to attention for eternity. The snow cover was pretty general, but here and there were tufts of brown grass that were tempting to the horse. I couldn't let her eat anything like that in case it had leached up poison from the soil, so I muzzled her with a feed bag to keep her from grazing. I had 1/2 sack of kibble for her, which would also take the edge off my hunger, but when that ran out, I didn't like to think how I would keep us both fed. I could eat the horse if it came to it. It wouldn't be the first time, but it would be a long walk home. As I scoured the old city for something to melt snow in, I was struck by how orderly it had all been left. Windows were mostly intact. Front doors were shut and padlocked. On the road back to the bridge was a big yellow mansion. Its front door lay off its hinges, all warped and swollen by the weather. Rags and broken furniture were piled up in the opened passageway. I'd seen similar sights enough times over the years in Evangeline to recognize that someone had broken in looking for firewood. It was a grand old building, with 2 pairs of columns holding up its portico and the number 1897 laid in tiles beneath it. I found a shower curtain, a pair of rusty ski poles, and the remnant of a fire at the foot of the stairwell. My first thought was that one of the prisoners had decided to disobey his instructions and shift for himself, and I went on up the stairs half expecting to run into him. But when I found him in the apartment on the first floor, I could see he wasn't one of ours. He lay on his front on a big Turkish rug, wearing the same fetters on his feet as ours had. I was afraid to touch him, so I turned him over by hooking his arm with an umbrella I found in the hall cupboard. I'll never forget how light he felt. It was like a shell with no snail in it. I could only turn him so far because something on his other arm had suppurated and glued itself to that heavy carpet, but there was no meat left on his face, and by the look of it, he was a year or two dead. In the bathroom, I found the remains of a killed pig. That pig might have been what did it for him. Mushrooms are the worst food to eat in a poisoned place because their roots are so high and widespread. But pig is scarcely better, since mushrooms are what they feed on. The staircase led up 5 stories where there was a second, narrower set of stairs that gave out onto the roof. The light off the snow was dazzling after the gloom inside. I fell to my knees and licked snow melt right off the slates. The rooftop commanded a view out toward the river. From it, I could clearly see the block post on the bridge and figures moving beyond it. Through the spyglass, I was able to tell the men apart, and I could watch them idling around their camp. They had a small fire going, so they must have found some clean wood somewhere. I knew their heads were hurting from the slow way they dragged themselves about. Toward 11, the first prisoners began appearing on the approach to the bridge. I didn't see them arrive because I was too busy melting snow from the roof in a pail. The lack of food in the zone didn't worry me so much, but without water, the horse and I would die in a couple of days. The second or third time I went up on the roof, I saw the guards had changed into white one-pieces with hoods and masks to cover their faces. It was hard to keep track of numbers. The guards all looked identical, and the prisoners had been made to sit in rows on the side of the bridge nearest to me. One by one, they were called forward to hand over whatever they'd found. They stood up, laid down the things they had, and then crossed over to the other side. When they were done, one of the guards came forward and hosed down the pile of dropped objects with a fumigator he wore strapped to his back. It was a weird-looking thing. Something like a cross between a weed sprayer and the smoke machine we used to use to put a hive of bees to sleep. I was all caught up with watching it when the first shots rang out. The next thing, a couple of the prisoners had broken free and were trying to get back across the bridge, but they could only manage a slow, loping run because of their chains. There was a volley of shots and one of the prisoners fell down. The other kept going for 10 or 15 yards more. He didn't fall flat. He slipped down and died upright, but on his knees, like a man at prayer. I'd never seen anyone die like that before. You wouldn't think gravity would allow it. The temperature began to drop again as night drew on. The eaves stopped dripping, and the slush on the roads hardened into ice. I'd stabled the horse inside the stairwell, but I was planning to spend the night outside, where the air was cleaner and I could keep an eye on the guards. From the roof, their fire was a tiny yellow spark in the blackness. The city was so still that an indistinct grunt or laugh occasionally carried all the way across the river. In the last hour before sunset, I broke into an apartment on one of the upper stories to try to find a blanket. The place had been left in perfect order. There was a vase of dried flowers on the kitchen table, a pair of sofas with antimacassars, a glass-fronted case of books in Russian, a dusty television, a standard lamp with an old frayed wire. The bed in the main bedroom had been stripped, and on it sat 2 zipped bags of sheets and blankets. A photograph, a clock, and a copy of the Bible lay on the bedside table. The second bedroom was half the size of the first and held a single bed. On the corkboard next to the dressing table were photographs of a dark-haired teenager. In some she was ice fishing, in others eating cotton candy and standing in the glass bubble of a huge Ferris wheel in a city I didn't recognize. Even after years of standing empty, there was something sweet in the air of that room. Some faint smell of dried roses behind the mustiness and the rat and roach poison that had been so conscientiously laid around the skirting boards. I found the girl's diary in the second drawer of the dressing table. It was all in Russian, but I knew what it said without having to read it. I could tell that it warned off snoopers with threats and spells. It rated the boys in her class for their promise as lovers and husbands. It charted the monthly cycles that were the first proofs of her womanhood, and it looked forward impatiently to a future that was already dust. I knew because I'd had one just like it. In the story of Goldilocks, the little girl sneaks into a bear den, eats the animal's food, and finds a place to sleep. That night I felt I was that story in reverse, a stinking, scarred bear, reeking of blood and gun smoke, turning up in a world of clean sheets and flowers. Sitting on that bed, I felt some part of me emerge, the way a snail does, soft and flinching, reaching up to the sunlight with its tender horns. So little of my life was human, at least not human in the way the girl who had once lived here would understand it. I thought about Ping, and if her baby had lived, maybe I could have made her a room like this one, and lost myself in the turning years, knowing I'd dug my patch and fixed my house and loved the people I was supposed to. The bronze head in the square spoke of a race with grand notions, but my bet is that all most people ever wanted was this. In the drawer where the diary had been stood a jar of cold cream, the cream inside all stiff and waxy with age. I smeared a fingerful on my wind-burned lips. The taste of it numbed my tongue the way soap does. I put the jar and the diary back and slid the drawer shut. It stuck, and as I jerked it free, I heard something rattle at the back. I drew it out, a perfect oval, flat and heavy, that sat in my hand like a turkey egg. It was so cool in my palm, I took it for a paperweight at first, until the fading sunlight showed the etched shapes on its upper side that told me it was a memory stone. Around 3 that morning, it started to snow again. It can't have been the sound that woke me up, because there was none. Maybe it was the change of light in the room. It poured out of the sky like feathers from a split pillow, big, warm weather flakes. It seemed to double the starlight as it whirred down past the glass of the bedroom window. I came to consciousness on that girl's bed, watching it fall, and I felt a kind of peace in me. It made me glad that this scaly old world still has so many pretty things in it. I must have drifted off again. Next thing I knew, the horse was hollering, and I was halfway down the stairs, shouting at whoever it was to get gone, with my gun cocked and my eyes still barely open. There was a mess of snow in the hallway, and someone had tried to unfasten the horse's bridle. They had fled at the sound of me yelling. I swung myself into the saddle and chased out after them. It turned out there was only one. I followed the tracks he had left as he labored through the snow with his chain on. I've hunted down some men in my time, but this one didn't take much catching. He was all broken with the weather and the short rations. The best he seemed able to do was to huddle in a shadowy alleyway and pray I mistook him for something else in the darkness. He waited and waited, hoping I'd pass along. Thinking of the plague and the withered man in the apartment, I didn't want to get too close to him, but I had no intention of leaving him be either, so that he could make more trouble. After what seemed like a foolishly long time, I shouted out to him that if he didn't show his face, I'd kill him as a stranger and sleep no worse for it. And then I broke and closed the breech of my gun with a snap, so there was no mistaking my intention. He shuffled forward out of the darkness on his knees and begged me not to shoot. When he looked up at me, the first flush of dawn in the sky behind me lit up his face. It was Shamsuddin. He squinted up at me and said my name as though it was a question. His voice was croaky and thick with thirst. Telling him to wait where he was, I went and fetched one of my pails of water for him. He clutched it in his arms and put his face in the bucket to drink. Between gulps, he raised his head and sat with his eyes closed, panting with relief and fatigue. The water dripped off his beard and back into the pail. When he offered the bucket back to me, I told him he could keep it. I guess I was pleased to see him alive, though I had no desire to let him near to me. It could have been Carlo, or my own pa in that place, and I still would have kept upwind of him and 10 yards between us. I didn't believe that the guards would have killed those men for nothing, or go to all that trouble with their masks and suits because they felt like it. Tolya knew more about the zone than I did, and he didn't trust to luck to stay healthy. Shamsuddin asked me about the others. I said the guards were waiting on the other side of the river, and as far as I knew, all the prisoners but him were dead. That seemed to surprise him less than I expected. Then I saw that he had fallen asleep. His face looked old and hollow, and the skin of it hung in baggy folds. I whistled him out of his slumber. It was cold enough that he would never come round if he slept there. He stumbled after me groggily. I led him to the stairwell and covered him with a heap of bedclothes from the apartment. At dawn, I went up to the roof to watch the sun come up over the city. It lit the glass in the distant windows of the second city, gold and bronze and some the greenish blue of cut ice. I took the memory stone up with me and laid it down so it could drink in the sunshine for a few hours and come to life. It looked even prettier in the daylight, bright and shiny as a knife blade. It had an ebony screen. There was some tiny writing on the front in Russian and a row of buttons marked with symbols that I couldn't recognize. They moved with a faint click at the lightest touch. On the back was written the only words I could understand. Made in China. The guards struck their camp and headed off an hour or so after sunrise. They moved slowly along the eastern bank of the river. I lay on my belly and followed them with the glass. They had just enough animals for the journey back. The sleds were loaded up with things that had been brought out of the zone. All the bodies had been left where they had fallen. The one that had died on his knees had keeled over in the night. The others lay piled under the fresh snow, too far away for me to count them, even with the glass. I put some kibble in a pillowcase for Shamsuddin to eat when he woke up. It was a nuisance keeping him in this half-assed quarantine, but I didn't know what else to do. I wasn't certain that he was a danger to me, but I couldn't risk it. I thought it was best not to touch him or anything he handled or ate, and not breathe the same air. He came round toward mid-morning. I watched from higher up the stairwell as he munched the food I'd left him. The sleep and water seemed to do him some good. He looked less deathly, and he had some of his old poise back. I said to him that the guards had gone and we were free to go.
"Free to go where?" he asked.
I shrugged and told him he could go where he liked. As for me, I was headed home. He gave me a mistrusting look. I sensed that business in the woods still hung over him. I said I wasn't minded to pay him back for thinking of killing me. I found it easy enough to forgive. I might have done the same. As far as I was concerned, we'd let bygones be bygones. At that, he came closer and offered to shake my hand on it. I told him not to mistake me and that I was shaking his hand in spirit, but that there were diseases and strong poisons in the zone and either one of us might have picked them up. I said until it was clear that we were both well, we should give each other a wide berth. Shamsuddin surprised me then by bursting into tears. He was tortured, he said, by the thought of what he'd sunk to. I told him not to mind it and that supposedly better men had sunk to a lot worse. Before I left, I collected the memory stone I'd put up on the roof. It was warm to the touch, but there was no life in it. I squeezed every button and even tried shaking it. The thing was just no good anymore. As I drew back my arm to pitch it into the river, its screen picked up the sunshine and cast it into my eyes. It was bright enough to make me wince.
I held it in my palm and turned it this way and that in the light. The glass of it was so true that it worked like a mirror. I hadn't seen my face up close for so many years, and to tell the truth, it looked a little better than I remembered. 20 years seemed to have taken the anger out of the scarring. I was a sight older, but my face looked more comfortable with itself. Not pretty by a long chalk, but no longer hideous. Or maybe I'd just imagined it was worse than it was. I decided to reprieve the mirror. I would hang it from a string above my seeds to keep the crows off. I liked the idea that it would have a second life as a bird scarer. I put it in my coat pocket with my tinder and flints. After a hunt, I found a hammer for Shamsuddin to break open his chains with. He went at it for a while and managed to get the chain off, but couldn't crack the fetters. We left the zone around noontime. There were about 400 yards of slush between us and the bridge. I walked the horse, but I kept 10 yards ahead of Shamsuddin. Whenever the squish of his footsteps got too close, I pressed on a little faster. Just stepping onto the bridge, I immediately felt different. I realized that I'd been breathing shallow the whole time I'd been in the city. The first body we came to lay a yard or two beyond the block post. It belonged to the man who had died on his knees, Zulfugar. I didn't linger there. The shell they used must have had a soft tip, because it had sprayed a peacock's tail of his insides across the snow. I pushed on to the campsite at the far side of the bridge. I was hoping that being a horse down for trip home, Tolia would have had to shed some rations, but all I could find at the spot was empty tins and bottles and their cold cooking fire. I raked the embers with my toe, just in case they had dropped some food. Shamsuddin was dawdling on the bridge. I looked up and saw him, stood on his knees by the body, head bowed, saying a prayer over the dead man, and I shouted to him not to get too close to him. He yelled back an oath at me in a thick, choked voice. I drew my gun and ran back after him, struggling to keep my footing in the slush and telling him not to touch the corpse or I'd shoot him. I was breathing hard by the time I caught up to him, but my gun sight was steady enough on his forehead. His eyes were all flared up. He jutted his chin at me as though to say he'd get as close as he wanted. Then he turned away from me, grabbed Zulfugar's sleeve to pull him up sitting, and hoisted the body from its armpits. It was an awkward lift, and he tottered as he got to his feet. I don't know if he thought I'd shoot. I don't think he cared by then. He buried the body in a bank of shale at the river's edge. I watched him from the track as he dug out a trench with his hands and pieces of flat stone. It was not much more than a foot deep, and it took him a while to get the body covered. We made our way slowly south as the light lengthened and the sky turned all blue and gold. Shamsuddin and I never said a word to each other until sunset. When we stopped, I cut us both branches to lie on. He offered to help, but I said he should keep his distance. His coat was still spotted with gore from the corpse. He'd buried his friend, and as good as buried himself, but he wasn't going to bury me. I made his bed a noisy one so I could keep an ear on him. The weather was warm for early March, but it was cold and comfortless without a fire, and I was too hungry to sleep. I was watching us both for signs of sickness. I didn't want to die now, not here, within an ace of being properly free. The twigs Shamsuddin was resting on rustled as he shifted his place. I told him that in a day or two we'd be able to hunt the wildlife and burn wood. There were fish in the rivers just south of here. We were too late for salmon, but there was pike perch and grayling. We'd leave them on the ice and carve them into frozen slices, stroganina. There were leaves and mosses we could eat. If it came to it, I could make famine bread from pine bark. I asked Shamsuddin if he'd ever eaten horse flesh. He said, not knowingly. I told him he was in for a treat. Horse makes a fine sausage, and the steaks are sweet and tender. The Yakuts eat the liver frozen raw, like meat ice cream. Shamsuddin said that in Harbin once he had eaten a meal that went on for 40 courses, and more than 10 of them were goat. I asked him where else he'd been. He reeled off a list of cities and then asked me where I'd traveled. Of course, I had to tell him that Palin was my first city proper, but I'd covered a lot of territory in the far north. "Make peace," he said. "You are a savage." He didn't mean it unfriendly, but the truth is, it stung a little. I'm sensitive on that score. My ways are rough. I've done brutal things. There's a shame in me at my ignorance, and the gulf between me and my parents. "Civilization and cities are the same thing," Shamsuddin said, "and that place is not a city. It is a tomb." I asked him how much he'd seen of it. "More than enough," he said. Shamsuddin told me that the prisoners had split into pairs almost as soon as they got across the bridge. There had been excitement at first. They had a little food each. They felt free. The ones like me who had never been to a city were in awe of it. For the men like Shamsuddin, there was some sadness, a sense of impossible return, the feeling of seeing a dead friend's face in a dream. He stopped his story for a moment, and I knew he was thinking of Zulfugar. Some of the prisoners ignored the maps and went to scavenge food or tools. The rest made their way through the city, following the route I'd taken. The maps they had copied led them to the square with a big bronze head in it, and then beyond, to the industrial part of the city, the place that Tolya had called Pauline 66. There was an immediate change in the look of the place. There were no more churches with onion domes or timber houses. The buildings were all taller, newer. Tanks and army vehicles lay abandoned in the street. Zulfugar got nervous, thinking the road was mined. Shamsuddin shared my view that our crew were only the latest to visit the zone. In an alleyway where he'd gone to piss, he stumbled on a heap of sticky rags, thigh bones, and a chain. Little by little, the other pairs of prisoners dropped away. Human nature being what it is, some were content to pick up any old flotsam and head back with it. Shamsuddin laughed as he remembered what they had taken. Old car batteries, the ball cock of a cistern, the cogs from a sewing machine. But others headed into the ruins of the city with a grim resolve. They used crowbars to break into old storerooms and stacked makeshift sleds with what they found there, hoping rather than trusting that Tolya would deal fairly with them. Shamsuddin and Zulfugar pressed on into the city, looking for one of the places marked on their map. When they found it, it turned out to be a playground. There were shoes and cans scattered around the place, a rusty carousel, a steel rocking horse, and swings that had rotted. Night was falling and Shamsuddin was ready to turn back, but Zulfugar had it fixed in his head that the map was wrong. As a soldier, he'd served sometimes with maps that had been tweaked to fool the unwary by hiding the location of important things, and he figured the true destination was about 200 yards further off. It took some scrambling to get over its outer wall, and Zulfugar cut his hand open. He tied it with a rag and boosted Shamsuddin in through a window. The drop on the inside was much further than he expected. He stiffened up as he fell and hit his head upon landing. He lay unconscious for a while, but he couldn't say for how long. When he came to, he looked up and saw the window was too high for him to climb back out again. He felt something drip warm on his hand. He had broken his nose in the fall. He said a panic seized him at the thought of dying alone in there. He shouted himself hoarse, calling out to Zulfugar. The foundations were deep and it was pitch black inside. Then, after a while, his eyes began to adjust to the darkness, and the pain of the fall abated. He stood up and began feeling his way around the walls of the building. It seemed to him that the floor sloped upward slightly in one direction, so he headed that way, hoping it would lead him above ground. The bunker was vast. Shamsuddin said that at times he thought he was going out of his mind, and at other times he feared he had died and was fumbling along in the corridors of the afterlife. After what seemed like hours of wondering, he felt broken glass under his feet, and looking up at the window he'd fallen through, realized he'd come full circle. That's when he gave up hope of escaping the labyrinth. He cursed God and threw himself against the wall, hoping to dash out his brains, but the darkness gave way in front of him. He found he'd stumbled through a kind of doorway into an inner chamber, and in this place he noticed a pale blue light coming from under a metal door. To his astonishment, the door swung open when he pushed it. It led into a huge storeroom lined with metal shelves 20 feet high. Stranger still, the blue light was not coming from a window, but from a shelf of blue flasks that were crackling and glowing. Shamsuddin was a man of science, but he said he had never seen anything that was like them, or the power that was in them. He reached for the drawings he had made at the base, but found he had lost them and his map in the fall. As he told me this, I heard the branches under him rustle. He was fumbling inside his jacket. I put one hand on my gun stock. I must have drawn breath as I did it because he looked up at me. He was yards away from me, but I could see his face clearly, the deep shadows in his eye sockets and the glint of gold in his teeth, as though lit by candlelight. What he had taken from his coat was one of the flasks he had described. I had imagined it like a light bulb, but the light it contained was neither solid nor steady. It moved and shimmered. It looked for all the world as though someone had caught a part of the lights in a mason jar. He stood it in the snow between us. The closer you got to it, the stranger it was. It had the power fire has of drawing your eye into it so you'd notice the tiniest things. The light had texture and depth like flame does, like the towers of Palin 66 seen from far off, but it had a quality of water, too. Moving, folding, closing, sending off little shoots of blue flame, rolling back on itself as though it was gathering its strength again. And all the time I could hear a faint hiss coming off the flask, like a live thing breathing. I wondered if this was what they meant by Daniel's fire. Shamsuddin had taken two of them from the rack and used their light to guide himself through the cellar. The light was too faint and scattered for him to see far with, but he was able to figure out that the space he was in was circular, and after about another hour of fumbling, he found a ladder bolted on one of the internal walls. It took him to the trapdoor in the roof. It was a big, heavy steel trap with bolts across the inside, but even when he'd undone them, he couldn't lift it. Leaf mold had settled in the hinges and was holding it closed. There was a crack of daylight visible where the door sat in the hatch, and he could smell fresh air. In his desperation to be free, he battered at the door with his fists, and it opened a little, and one of the flasks dropped. Shamsuddin said he'd flinched and covered his eyes, expecting a crash of glass or sparks or flame or worse. But the flask fell 10-20 feet and bounced as though it was made of iron. He left it there, laying in its own pool of blue light like a lantern at the bottom of a well. He had been underground so long that he thought Zulfugar would have given him up for dead, but not only was he waiting where he'd left him, nursing the wound on his hand, he'd also saved Shamsuddin's share of their rations, which he'd had for safekeeping. Shamsuddin ate his food and told him where he'd been, while Zulfugar took off his ragged mittens to touch and marvel at the flask. By this time it was getting close to the hour of the rendezvous. Zulfugar said they would have to leave, or risk getting there late. He stood up first and offered Shamsuddin his hand to hoist him to his feet. Shamsuddin looked at him in surprise and asked him for his other hand. Zulfagar showed him its back and front. The wound had knitted up without a mark. Zulfagar grabbed him fiercely by the coat and told him, "God is great." I asked Shamsuddin if he was sure it was the flask that did it. He swore five ways that it was, and said that it healed some smaller scrapes of his own. Then Zulfagar asked Shamsuddin if he thought he would be able to find his way back to the room where they were stored. Shamsuddin said he thought that with a rope and a lantern the return could be made pretty smoothly, though the truth was that he dreaded going back there. A change had come over Zulfagar. He puzzled over his drawings and found a number that matched one of the flask. His joy had given way to a kind of nervousness. It's the same when a green card player gets dealt a winning hand and he finds himself all sweaty and anxious at the thought of scooping the pot. Zulfagar was hatching a plan to barter the flask for their freedom. He said that if they went back to the bridge together, the guards wouldn't hesitate to strong-arm the flask off whoever had it. Instead, he told Shamsuddin that one of them should return while the other remained in the zone guarding it. His proposal was that Shamsuddin should go back empty-handed and tell Tolya exactly what he'd stumbled upon. In return for leading the guards to it, he was to ask for a week of rations and a horse. Time was ticking by. Shamsuddin had misgivings about the plan. He had a timid spirit, and his natural inclination was just to hand over the flask and trust to the good faith of the guards. Zulfagar would have none of that. He was pacing in the snow, ramping up his demands like the fisherman's wife in the fairy tale. 2 weeks of rations, a month of rations, a horse each, a gun. Right at the last minute, Zulfagar decided Shamsuddin should be the one to stay behind. Maybe he didn't trust his friend. More likely, he felt he was the shrewder bargainer. The trouble with Zulfagar's plan was that it credited the guards with too much intelligence. I don't think anyone but Apafagato knew exactly what we had been sent to the zone to find. You could copy pictures until your hand got cramped, and write down all the numbers you liked, but until you saw that flask with a light pulsing in it, you would never believe such a thing existed. I could see it right in front of me, and I had a hard time crediting it. Also, Tolya's speech about the zone had all the guards panicking. Even watching them through the glass, I could see they wanted to get their job done as quick as possible. As Zulfagar waited on the bridge with the other prisoners, he must have sensed that he'd miscalculated. Instead of being let loose on the other side, they were being corralled together like pigs waiting for the bolt. He'd turned to flee. Maybe he risked a bullet thinking that if he could just get back to the flask, he thought it would make him better. I'd seen what had unfolded next from my perch on the roof. That flask might be able to heal a graze or close up a cut hand, but it couldn't fix the hole they put in Zulfagar. We made good time over the next 2 days in spite of the dearth of food. Shamsuddin walked quicker without the chain, and we moved so fast that we had to watch that we didn't overtake the party of guards. I didn't dare risk hunting or a fire those first 2 days, not because of disease or radiation, but because I feared revealing our position. But on the third night, I snared a pair of rabbits and started to build a tiny fire to broil them on. That evening, Shamsuddin got a fever. It was by no means warm yet, but he complained about the heat, and even by the moonlight I could see his face was basted in sweat. He had taken it into his head that his flask, as well as mending cuts, would be proof against disease, and he had started laying it on himself when we stopped to melt snow or let the horse feed. I teased him for it. I told him that it was no medicine but pure juju, but he was ready with a theory about how it worked and even suggested I try it. "I'll take my chances with the germs I have," I said, "rather than sharing yours." Anyway, he was at it with his magic jar, rolling it over his sweaty forehead and up and down his arms, which he said ached. That gave me a bad feeling, and the truth was, I didn't feel so great myself. Also, the horse was skittish and off her food. I thought it would be a twisted kind of justice for us to get sick now. Digging in my pockets for the flints, my hand closed on the memory stone. I drew it out without thinking. When I had put it away 3 days before, the thing was dead. Now its face was all etched with green fire and the lights on it were winking and alive. The thought crossed my mind that it had drawn its power from the bottled lightning, or that whatever had been broken in it had been knit up by its closeness to the flask, but I pushed the idea out of my head for a piece of foolishness. Shamsuddin had noticed me pause and asked what I had. I showed it to him, and he told me how to make it play. It lit into life at my touch. Its screen took color and moved with pictures that showed the city as it had been, its streets all come to life, filled with people and transport. You couldn't see her at first, but there was a girl's voice in it, telling you what the pictures were. She was speaking in Russian, which I couldn't make sense of, but Shamsuddin translated. She said, "This is my school, this is where I live, this is my friend Daria," who was a girl giggling and covering her face with her hand. "This is my father, who is packing to leave." It became clear that all the bustle in the city was people getting ready to go. I understood why she'd made this thing. I've often wished I had a keepsake like it. It was a sampler with patches of the past worked into it. It should have been with her in the city she had gone to. It seemed a pity that she had forgotten it in a drawer. Then it showed her on her bed. The picture went wobbly and you could hear a girl laughing in the background. "Люди будущего," she said, or something that sounded like it. Shamsuddin sat up and said she hadn't forgotten it at all. She'd intended it to be left. "People of the future," she was saying, "whoever sees this message, I was born in the city of Polin, Russia. I am 18 years old. This is how I lived. This is who I was. This is how I lived. This is who I was." When Shamsuddin said those words, I felt a chill run through me. I saw that skull of a city with the life gone from it. I thought of the mounds of coins and ribbons beside the highway, and the scratches on the cell walls at Buktagachak, and the bronze head guarding the empty square. "You never expect to be at the end of anything," Boathwaite had said. But then he had his brother's arrogance. "The end is where you end up. You always end up at the end of something. So what is it that keeps you shambling out to the stable when it's 60 below, doing up the saddle with your fingers stiff with cold, or riding out in summer where you can't breathe for dust?" There are many words I've seen written down that I've never heard spoken. This is one I wouldn't know how to say exactly, but I know it's at the back of every other fear. It doesn't make sense to fear it because you're never around when it happens. Fear hunger or cold or the pain of sickness, but this? And yet, this is the one that preys on me. I bumped up against it in the darkness, hearing her say those words. "I fear annihilation." Boathwaite can say what he likes. A sane person knows they're headed for the end of something. But the thought that things will continue, that there'll be kind words at their funeral, or even just a pulse of blood in someone, somewhere, that dumbly recalls that they were here, that gives the rest of it some point. A sane person expects that. That girl had cast her message adrift on a sea of time so that she could live again, briefly, in the mind of whoever saw it. Maybe she didn't know that, but that's how it was. Everyone expects to be at the end of something. What no one expects is to be at the end of everything. When I woke up in the morning, there were 6 inches of snow on me. I was a little feverish, but Shamsuddin was badly ill. His skin was gray and he was breathing hard. He kept saying he'd be fine and he insisted we move off as normal, but he barely got 10 yards before he stumbled. He said not to get close, but I was all done with that. I figured I was gone, or as good as gone if he was. I helped him up from the place where he'd fallen, and I laid him back down on his bed and covered him with all the blankets we had. Then I boiled some soup from the rabbits and gave it to him, spoon by spoon, as he lay shivering. Between bouts of sweating, he was able to sleep, and I held his head in my lap. He felt like a baby. I thought about Ping, and as I pictured her face, I told him I loved him. He murmured in his sleep. The flush of fever in his face made him look almost youthful again. After an hour or two, he woke up and asked me if I held out hopes for the afterlife. I said no, but if anyone deserved it, he surely did. "I have been in Andalus," he said. "I think paradise will smell like the flowers of bitter oranges." I said I had always thought something similar. By then he had exhausted himself with speaking and just held on to me until the two of us were moved to a feverish intimacy, clinging together in loneliness and fear of death. When the sickness got bad again, he raved and told me to shoot him. In his lucid moments, he wanted to talk about his childhood. He said his mother had always been proud of him. I said I didn't doubt it. Just like the girl from Pauline, he wanted a witness. When the sun came out, I opened his jacket to get some fresh air on him. His skinny chest burned like fire. Later that afternoon, sores broke out on his face, and the infection spread to his lungs, so he had to sleep upright. The horse had sickened too, but I didn't have time to tend it. I boiled up some herbs in a bucket for him to breathe them in. That seemed to help him, and he slept easier that night. At first light, I was up to gather more plants. I found a bunch of them, and while I was doing it, I caught sight of a deer. I had my gun with me, and I thought, to hell with it. Either the sickness will get us, or Tolle's men will get us, but at least this way we won't die hungry. I was pretty dizzy with fever myself, and it took me 3 shots to put her down and 30 minutes to drag her back to our camp. She was a young female who must have got separated from her herd. Shamsuddin was sitting up but groggy, and I shouted out that we had fresh meat. It struck me that it would do him good to eat the liver, so I butchered that out first. By the time I was ready to cook it, I could hear that his breathing was rattling again. I went over to him, and his eyes were glazed, and he gripped my arm as he breathed hard, struggling like a man in a race. His tongue seemed dry and spongy, however much water I tried to put down him. Maybe if I'd used a bullet, he would have died more comfortable. But I couldn't do it. About noon, Shamsuddin died. Then the horse died. But I lived. Well, that's the kind of luck I've had. Part 4. Chapter 1. After the horse died, I had to go on foot. I delayed setting out in order to bury Shamsuddin, and then I moved on southeast, feeling my way through the taiga for the start of the highway that would take me home. It was the worst season to travel. Meltwater made even the smaller rivers impassable. And if you got wet and then the temperature dropped, you ended up with your pants all armored with ice. I'd always been a wiry and uncomplaining sort. 4 hours of sleep would get me back to myself after a day's work. Now I was aching and short of breath. I'd stop every hour, then every half hour, then every 15 minutes. Finally, I was walking for 100 yards and resting for 5 minutes. I carried my belongings on a birch frame which dug into my arms. Soon I was too weak to hunt. The ground was soaked through, so with the last of my strength I lopped the branches off a larch and spread them out for a bed. Then I crawled onto it and waited to die. I must have lain there for days as the sickness worked its way through me. Day and night wheeled about the sky. On the third or fourth morning, I sat up and drank a pint of water from the stream in my cupped hands. Why I should have been spared, I couldn't think. I heard a tale later that the plague in Pauline was an artificial one, engineered to be deadly to men but to spare women. It wasn't out of any sense of chivalry, just practical to kill male soldiers and leave females behind to wait on the victorious army and bear children. It sounds unlikely, but not unlikelier than many other things I know to be true. As soon as I was strong enough to stand, I hoisted up my pack and stumbled on. I picked fiddleheads and ate them as I walked. A couple of them had caterpillars on them, and I munched them, too, because I was so hungry. I was thinking about counting my shells and seeing if I could spare some to hunt with when I smelled a terrible sweetness on the wind. About 200 yards further on, I came upon a heap of bodies stacked like logwood. Some were half-dressed, but most had been stripped, and their limbs were naked and waxy in the sunlight. The remains of the caterpillar went bitter in my mouth. They had been killed with blades, and some were only trunks. Tolya's head sat on top, mouth downcast, winking out from under drooping eyelids. The bodies were soft with decay, and ants were busy on their mouths and eyes. I guess they had been dead 2 or 3 days. The tracks of their attackers had melted away with the snow, but here and there were dropped objects, a boot, a saddlebag, saucepans, that made me think the struggle had been in the dark. The guards were well armed. I doubted that anywhere else in the region were there such guns and weapons as they carried. It would have taken a large number to subdue them by force. But the relief of surviving the zone and the power of their guns might have made them unwary. If someone had come stealthily, sneaked up on them at night, they might have been too drunk or bleary-eyed to defend themselves. I blacked my face with dirt, loaded my carbine with all the shells I had, and skirted the track until darkness fell. It was the mildest night we'd had since autumn. The land was shedding winter like a wet dog shaking itself dry. Now and again a chunk of damp snow flopped out of the branches and made a sound like a footfall. Each time I heard one drop, I flinched. I sat and snoozed under a tree for a couple of hours before dawn. When I opened my eyes, it was still dark. There was silence. Then I felt a blade at my throat and a hand close over my mouth. It smelled of soil and caribou meat. The prick of the knife in my neck forced me up on my feet. I wasn't aware that I was scared, but I peed myself like I had that time in the lake. A little light was coming into the sky, but it wasn't any comfort to be able to squint down at my chin and see that whoever had got me was wearing Tolya's watch. He marched me out to the track and gave a low whistle. Horses and men appeared from the woods. The heap of bodies wasn't more than 2 miles behind us. They talked quietly in a throaty language that I guessed was Yakut. I had never had much dealings with the Yakut, but I knew them to be a tough, horse-herding people. They had flat, dark faces like Kazakhs and were dressed in a ragbag of clothes. I spotted a few hats and coats that I remembered as belonging to the guards. What surprised me most was that, bundled up as they were, I still recognized women among them. I knelt in the slush, listening to their chatter. It sounded like a conversation you might overhear at a market, except they were haggling over me. The higher voice of a woman was as forceful as any of them. I could guess what they were saying. Mercy or no mercy? Kill her here or over there? Who gets to keep her stuff? My hand felt raw and wet. I'd lost a glove stumbling out of the woods, but that didn't seem to matter anymore. Whoever held the knife in my throat joined the conversation from time to time. I dreaded hearing his harsh, raised voice in my ear, because whenever he spoke, he pressed the knife harder, and I had to tip my head back to keep him from cutting me. A faint blue haze was beginning to light the sky from the east. Flawless Arctic blue. I knew for certain there was nothing waiting beyond it. No other worlds. No Mother, or Pa, or Carlo, or Shamsuddin. No Ping. And yet, I found myself muttering the words of the Our Father over and over again, as though it was something to bite down on so I wouldn't cry out in pain. Someone else came up beside me. A hand wiped the dirt roughly off my face. A new voice spoke and talked on a while. The knife stopped cutting into my windpipe and I fell forward onto my belly. The ground had the earthy, damp smell of mushrooms. I lay there nose down for a while as they argued back and forth above me. No one stopped me as I got to my feet. Standing beside me was the boy from the zone, the Tungus boy. The man who was arguing with him turned away in disgust. A woman with a chapped red face was breastfeeding a baby. On the little pony beside her was a pale-skinned girl of about 10. Her eyes were so light that she couldn't have been native, and she had fair hair curling out of her bushy fox fur hat. I almost cried out in surprise, but she looked straight through me with a stony gaze you'd use to aim a gun. Tolya's icon was fixed to the lapel of her coat. One by one, the Yakuts went back to their horses, until only the boy stood beside me. He never met my eye or gave the least indication that he knew me. I watched them drift away into the forest. The woman with her baby rode behind the man wearing Tolya's jacket, and the white girl didn't give a backward glance. Soon there were only two of them left in the clearing with their horses, the boy and the man with the knife. The boy patted the flank of his horse, but instead of swinging up into its saddle, he handed me the reins and got up on the other horse behind his friend. He looked back at me for an instant with a blank face of a stranger. There was no kindness or understanding in his expression. I can't say what he might have been thinking. It would be nice to suppose he did me a good turn for the one I did him, but there is no telling how grace works. I don't even know if there is a word for mercy in Yakut. The imprint of his empty eyes stayed with me when he turned away. He dipped his head as the two of them rode under a branch which scattered snow down his back. In 10 more yards they had vanished, and the drip of the thaw swallowed the sounds of their hooves. I thought of the curt way I turned him loose that time by the riverbank, and of the times out hunting when I just held my shot on a whim or threw back fish because they were too small. They never lingered to speculate about my motives. It would be consoling to think there is a pattern of justice in things, but I've seen enough to be sure that there isn't. My father would point to what the boy did and say it was the redeemable part of his humanity. Maybe. Rarer than a tadpole in a hailstone, that's what it was. But if I killed 10 caribou, butchered them for their meat and skins, and then freed a snared rabbit just for the pleasure of watching its fluffy behind vanishing in the bracken, would that make me St. Francis? I'd be deceived to think so. The horse licked my bare hand. My pack and glove lay under the tree where I'd been woken. I found them, swung my stiff body onto the horse, and aimed her nose at the sunrise. Chapter 2. I kept away from the track we'd come out on, in case Boathwaite had sent a party to find where we'd got to. It meant slower going, but I had the whole summer to get home in. At night I'd see my route in the sky mapped out in a pattern of stars. The Lena takes a great swerve to the west, but it ends up almost due south of Paling, right near the base. I was planning to cut out that bend altogether and ride southeast until I struck the Commissar's highway. As long as I kept on roughly in the right direction, I couldn't miss it. It was a straight line east to west. And once I was on it, there was less than 1,000 miles between me and Evangeline. I could be home in 6 weeks. Some evenings I'd pull out Shamsuddin's blue